Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator today. We are very glad you could join us. I do see we have some first-timers, and we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate along with us. Now, today's topic is the tornadoes that struck the southeast during the end of April. For the three-day period, April 25th through 28th, NOAA estimates a total of 305 tornadoes, shattering the previous record set in 1974. And according to the National Weather Service storm survey teams, there were over 24 killer tornadoes in six states: Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, and Virginia, including three in the EF5 category that caused over 300 fatalities. But first, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with a presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. Now, if you have any difficulty with live meeting, you may click on the feedback drop-down menu up here at the top right to change your colors to indicate that you need some assistance. And then my associates, Ava Jean Moore and Lori Weber, will monitor that and try to help you. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program. We also ask you not to send any private messages to the speaker or the moderator, as we will be busy. We are making a recording, which should be available later this afternoon, and as I mentioned last time, we are making an audio-only MP3 version of our programs now, which you will be able to access directly from our website, or you can subscribe to a podcast now available from the iTunes store. The text transcript will be posted early next week, and if you're not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice when these materials are ready and, of course, future programs. Now, it is my great pleasure to introduce today's guest. Dr. Harold Brooks is a research meteorologist and head of the Modeling, Observation, and Analysis Team at the National Severe Storms Laboratory, also known as NSSL, maybe I'm not sure how to pronounce that, NISL?
NISL.
In Norman, Oklahoma. In 2002, he received the United States Department of Commerce's Silver Medal for his work on the distribution of severe storms in the United States, and in 2007, he received the NOAA Administrator's Award for work on extreme weather and climate change. He is currently on the steering committee of the European Conference on Severe Storms and was recently named a fellow of the American Meteorological Society. Please check out today's background page for further information and links related to today's topic. Welcome, Harold. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
You're welcome. And even though Amy and I practiced this some yesterday, I probably will do something really bad here in the early stages of making this work, and she'll have to rescue me, but hopefully it won't be too bad. The month of April was a very active month for tornadoes in the United States, and particularly the last week. And I'm going to focus today almost entirely on the April 27th portion of that. Even though there were killer tornadoes on the 25th and the 26th. Almost all of them were on the 27th. We're right now estimating 350 people were killed on that one day alone, and nine on the other two days, the 25th and the 26th. So the 27th was the big day. We're still actually working a lot trying to figure out exactly in terms of the casualties. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about the forecasting of the day and what went on if you had been watching in the days ahead, what you might have seen. An experimental forecast that the Storm Prediction Center put out actually from the week before had indicated that Tuesday and Wednesday would be active days in particular, but the first official forecast that looked at that came out on Monday morning, and we're showing here the probability of a severe thunderstorm within 25 miles of any location. The peak probabilities are 45% on this day, which for the outlook that's put out more than 48 hours in advance, that's about as high as the Storm Prediction Center ever goes. And in fact, when they put their product out on that Monday, they had what's called a moderate risk for severe thunderstorms on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and it was the first time they'd ever had a moderate risk on all 3 days of the main outlooks and since they've been doing that in since they've gone to 3-day outlooks about 10 years ago. And the hatched area in there, with the little diagonal lines, is indicative of what's called severe thunder, significant severe thunderstorms. So 2-inch and larger hail, F2 and greater tornadoes, or hurricane force winds. So that was we're obviously highlighting northern Mississippi, eastern Tennessee, up perhaps as much as into Kentucky. And as the day went on, the next day, the outlook expanded a little bit further north. But in the text product that was associated with it, they discussed that the northern end of that may not be realized. They were concerned about the convection the thunderstorms from the 26th. If they occurred, that might actually limit the northern extent of the really severe thunderstorms. And in fact, that's what occurred. So that it's possible that if the thunderstorms on the 26th over the night of the 26th and early morning of the 27th had not occurred, we might have in fact had a larger area that on the 27th than we actually ended up having. So the morning of the 27th, the convective outlook, the first product that the Weather Service puts out, or the Storm Prediction Center puts out in the upper left-hand corner, uses categories of slight, moderate, and high risk of severe thunderstorms. And the high-risk area highlighted northern Mississippi, southern Tennessee, or northern Alabama, northeastern Mississippi, southern Tennessee, and northwestern Georgia. And then the tornado probabilities in the bottom right-hand corner, 30% probability, and the hatched area now is at least a 10% chance of a F2 or greater tornado within 25 miles of the location. And this forecast would have come out at 2 a.m. Eastern time, 1 a.m. Central time. And so you can see that the major area that was highlighted was the northern part of Alabama and sort of the surrounding areas. Several hours later, when that forecast was updated, they in fact increased the probabilities of significant tornadoes, moved things back a little bit to the southwest, perhaps for the emphasis. But this area, as we'll see, was a remarkably good forecast. This came out at 11:30 in the morning on Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning, and then or 10:30 on the Central Time. And so this actually highlighted the main axis of what ended up being the main killer tornadoes, including the Birmingham Tuscaloosa storm, which is sort of down in here, the Hackleberg and Phil Campbell storm that went up into Tennessee, and then the Smithville, Mississippi tornado that was over in this region. So those were the three of the biggest killer tornadoes. There was another one up in the northwest part of the Mississippi or of Alabama through DeKalb County, and then a fourth one that was later on in the evening that came out of northwest Georgia and went up into southeastern Tennessee. So there were five really major killer tornadoes that killed more than 20 people each. Now, as the day went along, tornado watches were issued. These are four of the watches. There were a total of 16 watches issued on the day. I've highlighted the four in the main area. They're in time order. They're issued the upper left-hand corner, then the upper right-hand corner, then the bottom left-hand corner, and the bottom right-hand corner. And this display actually highlights the counties that were shown that were in the tornado watches. They came out, and then the radar pattern at the beginning of when the watch was first issued, and the times that the watches are issued are below them. And you can actually see in the upper left-hand watch, this line here of strong storms is actually the remnant of the overnight convection that had actually led to a few deaths in northeastern Alabama and another couple back in northeastern Mississippi, and later on in the north, another line that had actually had a fatality that's off the screen in northeastern Alabama. So there have been two sets of storms the night before, and now the new storms are starting to form back sort of along the Mississippi River, and this is the beginning of storms, of one of the lines of storms that would lead to fatalities. You can see the very faint hint of a radar echo that's associated with another line of storms, and actually in between the very beginning of what is the third line. So these were the three primary lines of storms overnight or during the daytime. The second watch that came out, we covered most of Alabama, and you can see now this is issued 3 hours later almost, and you can see the storms that are forming, that have already formed back in Mississippi, that are going to become killer tornadoes. Then a couple hours later, the watch was issued that covered the eastern and middle Tennessee, and you can now at this time you can actually see down in this area. This is actually the storm that produced the fatalities in Chickasaw and Monroe County, Mississippi. This is the storm. I believe this is the storm actually that produces the Hackleberg and Phil Campbell tornado, and then this is the beginning of the storm that comes up through DeKalb County, northeastern Mississippi, or northeastern Alabama. I'm sorry, I keep confusing that. I shouldn't do that. And we're beginning to also see the storm that produces the tornado at Tuscaloosa. This is the storm right there in its early stages that produced all of the dramatic video. And then the final watch that was issued that's really relevant to most of the major fatalities was one that covered most of Georgia and then up into southwestern North Carolina. And this was primarily valid in the late night hours. So those were the four main watches. Like I said, there were a total of 16 that covered most of the rest of the severe weather on the day. But these were the four that really were most of the damaging events occurred. Victor Gensini, a graduate student at the University of Georgia, has put together this very nice map that showed where all the tornado warnings were issued during the day. And this is a real nice visual of where action occurred. There were tornadoes as far north as New York State. The fatalities in Virginia were all in the southern part of Virginia and southwestern parts of Virginia, one associated with this line of storm. And you can almost pick out the lines of the storms as they moved northeast. And we get a real picture that north central Alabama was sort of a major target area where a lot of things occurred. And again, into eastern Tennessee, where all the polygons associated with the warnings kind of cover up to where you can't even see the map in the background. And you also see that one thing that actually perhaps lessened the impact of the event for what it could have been even more catastrophic was you actually see that there were storms that went south of Atlanta and storms that went north of Atlanta, but the Atlanta metro area was not particularly impacted much by the storms, and there's almost they almost split on their way going around there. But this is an idea of how there were I believe that the number was I think 600 tornado warnings were issued during the day, maybe a little bit less than that, but it was a large number covering just a huge area in the eastern part of the United States. And the initial reports from that day, these are what are referred to as the preliminary reports of the day. Preliminarily on that one day, there's 292 tornado reports. It's important to note that many of those are duplicate reports. A tornado on the ground for 60 miles may have 10 or 20 or more reports associated with it, potentially different people seeing it and reporting into the system. But that gives you an idea of some of the long track events down here, say in Mississippi. You can see this long line here that's probably all associated with one tornado, and then another couple that come out through northwestern Alabama, northeastern Mississippi. One of the tornadoes the tornado that hit Hackleberg, which is in Marion County, Alabama, actually went all the way up into southern Tennessee and was on the ground for about 130 miles. And so there's lots of reports from that one particular one. The blue dots are wind reports and the green dots are hail reports. One of the things we've noted in the past is that there are very few hail reports that make it into the database of severe weather reports. When there are large tornadoes on the ground in the vicinity, people tend to concentrate on the tornado part. This was initially 292 preliminary reports. We're probably going to end up for the one day with somewhere in between 150 and 170 final reports as some of these multiple reports get put together into one tornado. And then as damage surveys are done, it's possible they actually sometimes find additional tracks of tornadoes as they were going along. The killer tornadoes on the day, on the single day, right now we believe there are 25 tornadoes that killed people. This uh, was this graphic was put together showing those tracks by Greg Carbon yesterday. We've now gotten a little bit more information that's lowered the death toll at the moment to about 305, although we're still trying to calculate some things. There's probably an additional death in northwestern Georgia that's not in the database yet. But the primary killer tornadoes, the numbers you see on the sets of numbers you see, there are numbers that indicate the time in UTC time. So subtract 5 hours to get central daylight time or 4 hours to get eastern daylight time. So this was 2220 to 0:00, so that's 6:20 p.m. to 8 p.m. This is the black numbers are the number of deaths in a particular county. For instance, this is 39 deaths in Tuscaloosa County and 20 in Jefferson County, which is where Birmingham is. So this is the Tuscaloosa-Birmingham tornado. 59 deaths are associated with it right now. And then the very long track tornado that comes out of Marion County that starts with 24 deaths there and 26 in Franklin County and has right now, I believe, 71 deaths is what we're estimating occurred with that right now, or 75 deaths. We're still attempting to get all that counted up. And another tornado, 26 fatalities in DeKalb County. So this is the path of the tornadoes, and again, killer tornadoes went up as far as Virginia. This does not include the stuff that happened in the early morning on the very early morning on the 27th or on the 25th or 26th. There were killer tornadoes as far back as central Arkansas to go back as far as the 26th. Well, so that's a picture of what happened on the day in terms of the impact. But I wanted to do a little bit of meteorology and show you what things looked like. And this is an image of a couple of different tornadic thunderstorms. The one on the left is the May 3rd, 1999 Oklahoma City tornado that went through Moore and Bridge Creek in Oklahoma City, very near me. And the one on the right is the Tuscaloosa tornado. This is as it's going through Tuscaloosa. You can see where the radars are located, the little black dots. And these are essentially the same size. The horizontal scale is the same on both maps, so that you see that both storms are about the same size. You see the characteristic classic hook echo, and down in the part of the hook, there you'll see if you look very carefully, there's a couple of pixels of purple in both cases, and that's actually debris that you're being seen in the air. In the Oklahoma City tornado, this is essentially the west side of Moore, Oklahoma, being hit. And Tuscaloosa, this is as Tuscaloosa is getting hit. And pieces of building materials look very bright on radar. They're very good reflectors, and so they show up. The rest of the colors, the reds are heavy rain, and we go down to lighter rain with the yellows and the greens. But these two storms look remarkably similar. We actually see the remnants of a northern storm on Tuscaloosa and the beginnings of another storm back off to the west that you can see on the Tuscaloosa map, but they look very similar. If we look on the larger scale, a product that's recently been developed at the Severe Storms Lab is what we call rotation tracks. Essentially, you look at the velocity data out of the radar, and you see where the velocity data says that we probably ought to be having something that's rotating. It doesn't identify a tornado, but identifies rotating thunderstorms, and we can actually just to give you an idea of the scope of the outbreak last week, all the yellowish background lines you see over on the right-hand part of the map, this goes from the 25th all the way through the 27th, and each one of these individual lines is essentially one individual thunderstorm that's rotating. So that this storm, perhaps, that we're looking at, that I'm drawing the line along, has a rotating component to it all the way across the state of Mississippi, or starting in Mississippi all the way across the state of Alabama. The one to its north actually continues all the way up through Georgia into southwestern North Carolina. There's another one that if we follow it through somewhere in here that he actually travels all the way up into Virginia with strong rotation, not necessarily a tornado, but strong rotation over about a 300-plus mile long path. To put this into comparison, the green part over on the left side is actually the rotation track associated with the May 3rd, 1999 outbreak. It is missing a storm because we don't have the data off of the radar that was in Wichita at the time. It is missing a rotation track up in Wichita, but that was a very large impact tornado outbreak with lots of, with over 60 tornadoes on the day. And just for comparison, just the geographic area that's covered by the rotation tracks from last week is just an amazing thing. This was the last week was certainly a very large outbreak, probably one of the six largest outbreaks in U.S. history, and the largest one since 1974. There were tornado tracks that right now they'll probably end up with about 2,000 miles in total path length of tornadoes, and that compares to the 2,600 miles in the on the April 3rd, 1974 super outbreak that actually hit some of the same counties and in southeastern Tennessee, even hit the there were fatalities on the same street in April 3rd, 1974 and in last week's or the same road in last week's tornado. So some of the same places that were hit, although more of last week's there were more damaging tornadoes in April 3rd up in up into Ohio. So that's sort of a large scale picture. A little bit of damage pictures. This is out of Hackleburg, Alabama, city in where there were, I believe right now it looks like there were 18 fatalities in Hackleburg. In the background is steps that led up to, I believe, a church in Hackleburg at the time. That there's nothing left of the foundation of the other than the steps going up to it. This is the Wrangler Gene distribution facility in Hackleburg. Hackleburg, one of the long-term impacts is that this was the primary employer in the city, and it's obviously not in very good shape anymore. The parent company of Wrangler is attempting to figure out where they could put a facility close to Hackleburg, at least temporarily, so that people could go back to work soon. There was one fatality in this building when it collapsed, and you can sort of see how walls have fallen out. Cars have gotten thrown into the walls, and now had the walls fall onto them in the parking lot. But this is there was only the one fatality. But in terms of economic impact, if they can't get the people back to work, this was the by far the largest employer in the town. Phil Campbell. A small town just northeast of Hackleburg in the next county, and this is a house that's essentially lost all of the flooring and taken off of the foundation, and you can also see lots of tree damage. And so this is indicative of at least F4 damage. This may have been this. I'm not sure if this building itself was looked at F5, but you can actually see where in the middle here where essentially, the carpet's gotten rolled up by the tornado. It managed to stay attached on one end, but on the other end, the carpet was actually detached from the flooring and has gotten rolled up in the middle of the house. This is an image from Smithville, Mississippi, where there were 15 fatalities, lots of damage, lots of debris here. This is one of the images that may become sort of one of the images of the damage, in that there is they found a Ford Explorer that had blue paint on it, and they couldn't find any blue paint in the vicinity, and someone noticed that apparently that the water tower had been hit by the Ford Explorer. It was thrown up into the big thing up at the top of the water tower at the tank. And there's actually a little bit of paint missing off of the top of the water tower, and someone went up there and they've already done some chemical analysis, and indeed this Ford Explorer hit the tank of the water tower and bounced away. It was unoccupied at the time, fortunately, but that gives you an idea of the kind of power that was associated with these tornadoes. Smithville was another place that was rated with EF5 damage. And then into larger areas, this is a housing complex in Tuscaloosa. And you can see, a wide gradation of damage here. The buildings on the south side are essentially F2 damage, perhaps at most. Roofing material has been lost off of the one on the right end, but that is mostly, survivable without significant injuries in most of those bottom three buildings, up to where you have all of the roofing material gone. Which is indicative of F3 damage, and there are in fact a few vehicles that have apparently been thrown perhaps into the mess of this housing complex. It's likely that people in here if they would have been in small room shelters, unless something like a car had fallen on them, that would have survived the prevent injuries. But this is certainly, in general terms, it's certainly a survivable event. But this is a lot of what Tuscaloosa looked like over a larger scale. And in fact, I've attempted to piece together some of the aerial images that were taken by a NOAA overflight from the Coast and Geodetic Survey. And this is actually a path through Tuscaloosa. You can see Bryant-Denny Stadium, where the University of Alabama plays football, up on the upper left. And so the tornado passed mostly south of the campus area, and you can see the track of the tornado essentially as this line that goes through. There were fatalities, I know, at the overpass here on the highway on the southwest side of town. But what you're frequently seeing when you see the light area here in this line is there's lots of damage, but there's also essentially piling up of debris along the center line as flow comes together. The Coast and Geodetic Survey has done overflights over several of the paths, and this is actually a composite of four of their images that are put together. But they've covered all of the damage paths on the Birmingham Tuscaloosa storm, over Smithsville, and over several of the other tornadoes, and that some really amazing images that are very high quality, very high resolution. I think these are actually the low resolution images that I put together, and I actually had to scale them down to even get them to fit. So the high resolution images. So I believe the resolution is supposedly less than a meter on the images off of this plane. So really high, lots of data that can be provided with information. Okay, so that's sort of an overview of last week's event. Amy sort of asked me for a little bit on what might be happening in the future that might help us in these kinds of events in the future. One of the things we do a lot here at the Sphere Storms Lab is looking at radar, Doppler radar that was deployed into the field in the early 1990s, played a huge role in quality warnings. Over 90% of the tornadoes and all of the killer tornadoes had warnings issued prior to the tornado occurring, and they are and on average those the times the between the tornado warning and the tornado was on the average of 24 minutes over the entire outbreak. So in the future, radar will continue to improve, and one of the things that's going on right now is polarimetric radar. And really the big benefit out of polarimetric radar is that it improves precipitation estimates. And it allows us to discriminate between different kinds of precipitation types, between heavy rain and hail. It essentially sends out two beams out of the radar, and you can do all kinds of wonderful things with that. And it turns out it also makes it even more obvious to see tornado debris. Since it certainly doesn't look like hail or rain, the polarimetric radar signature of debris is strong and may in fact work even when we aren't seeing things like the debris ball of the purple dots that I showed you earlier. Okay. The other two radars I'll show you a little bit of example from are phased array radar and a gap filling radar. And I'm going to show you some images from a tornado or from storms that occurred a year ago yesterday, very near me. In fact, one of them touched down about 300 yards south of my office. This is an image from an experimental phased array radar we have here that shows reflectivity on the right, and you can see in this case we're zoomed way in. We're basically looking at the tip of the hook in this from the other storm, and you can see the hook coming around. And this really bright debris ball that shows up, that's a few kilometers across on the right, and then on the left side is the velocity signature. And so you've got winds blowing away indicated by the red and winds towards the radar in the green. And this is essentially the rotating signature associated with the larger scale rotation. Down here in the very small area, there's a little bit of enhanced signature that's associated with the tornado itself. We're almost looking inside of the tornado in this case. The phased array radar is a military technology that's been around for a number of years. Current radars, conventional radars, have a dish that spins and collects data as it spins and then It makes a circle, you tilt it up a little bit, it makes another circle, you tilt it up, and it makes another circle. And it takes about 5 to 6 minutes to collect an entire volume of radar data information. Phased array radars, instead of being mechanically steered, are electronically steered. It's got a whole bunch of beams that come out from it, and you essentially can point them in almost instantly at what you want to look at. And to collect an entire volume of data and process it takes less than a minute. And you can actually, while you're doing that, you can do lots of other things with the radar. You can tell a few of the elements of the radar to look in a particular area, like if there was a tornado. You still wanted to know what was going on in the rest of the area, so you didn't get caught by surprise. You could spend a little bit of time in the region of the tornado and perhaps get updates on it every maybe 10 to 15 seconds, which, depending on what's going on, it's incredibly valuable. It also has the capability of doing non-meteorological things very well, to where it can be used as an aircraft tracking radar, which is essentially what the Navy on their ships uses it for, is looking for either friendly or unfriendly aircraft approaching. And as a result, it is possible that the phased array radars could be in place in about 10 years and might replace a set of 7 radar networks that currently exist in this country for weather and aviation purposes, and would be able to do both of them at the same time, which would be a major cost savings in the long run, and provide much better data and much more information, hopefully allowing for people to make better warning decisions when they do that. Another image from a second phased array radar that's experimental here in the Norman area. This is a setup. You can actually see 3 different circulations. The left panel is velocity signatures off of the terminal Doppler weather radar in Oklahoma City, which is intended primarily for warning of aviation hazards at the Oklahoma City airport. But then you can see 3 velocity signatures, 1 very large one. This is the one we were just looking at from a different angle at a slightly different time. And then we've got 2 more down here on the bottom left. And associated with those is the reflectivity signature from another phased array radar. To the right, you actually see the hook echo from the main part of the storm, and then another circulation that's out east of that that's associated with this velocity signature. This part has actually been moving northeast and produced a relatively weak tornado. The western signature, this one continued to move east and killed one person, and then another tornado killed someone else later on during the night. This is actually, my office is right about there. So this was one that was relatively close to us. And in fact, actually, the reason that I couldn't show an earlier image was that the people who run the reflectivity radar had for some reason decided to abandon their post as the circulation passed just south of them, and so they turned off the radar for a minute and then went back or didn't collect data for a few minutes and then went back to it. But we can see really spectacular images, and this uptake time of a minute is a really interesting concept that should have a lot of value. The other kind of radar that exists is that's being tested here in the area is called CASA. It's a adaptive sensing system where a set of radars that right now there are 4 in the network are used in conjunction with each other, and essentially rather than just having one radar looking where it ought to look, the 4 radars intelligently communicate with each other and decide on where the most, based on a set of rules, decide on what the most interesting weather event is, and they'll focus resources there and get a picture within an area. And this is being compared to the current Doppler radars. These small radars are gap-filling radars that aren't very strong, but you can put them in between where current radar coverage is. And since right now one of the problems that we have is that since the Earth curves, the bottom of the radar beams are well above the ground when you get only 30 or 40 miles away from the radar. And so putting these small power, what are sometimes referred to as cell phone tower radars, you could actually look in real detail at the various lowest levels. And you can also make them look very quickly because of their adaptive scanning strategies. And so what we have here is a set of images over a 10-minute period of a couple of of a tornadic storm, a small tornadic storm that's actually only about 50 miles from the radar, or less from the NEXRED radar. The signature associated with it in the NEXRED is right here. This is actually an anticyclonic storm, so it was rotating clockwise instead of counterclockwise like most tornadoes. And what we have is the bottom panels are the 4-minute updates in this case from the NEXRED radars. And they're looking, again, probably the lowest scan is probably half a mile above the ground. So here's the tornadic signature. And again, over here, and so I've got the right direction this time. And then down here a few minutes later. But you're looking well above. You don't have very much resolution. And this is a small tornado. It doesn't look like very much is happening. With the CASA network, with the ability to update every minute, you see the signature occurring here. And then it stays right with us as we go to 1 minute later, and another minute, and another minute, and so on. Intensifies, becomes a little bit of a bigger signature as we go along. And so with this 1 minute update, this is the kind of thing that it is likely that while this initial point right here on the radars might have in fact gotten someone's attention in the forecast office, it was still pretty small. And they might not have been able to see very much of it. And might not have known things. It's not clear that the signature here on this one would have really attracted much attention at all. But that with this very close to it radar, we were able to see things over a great period of time. And that might be a really big benefit for helping, especially sort of near metropolitan areas where you might want a little more information in terms of improving the warning system. Beyond radar, is one of the things that we're looking at is how we can improve forecasts of the events. One of them is to run an ensemble based on of models based on radar input, run it just for a few hours instead of most forecast models are run for days now, and then we'll generate probability of environmental conditions. Sort of the image that we have is here's a storm that's developing, and because we can take the radar information, put it into the model, and we can make an estimate of that in an hour from now, there will be some kind of a tornado that will be occurring, and this is the probability the tornado will be occurring, and this is the most likely path. And then if everything works out right, you know, the tornado, the storm ends up right in the middle of where we said it would be. This is the kind of thing that is being developed, and we're hoping that we can be working on this kind of a technology that will be available 7 to 9 years from now. And it would be the kind of thing that rather than currently what we do is essentially we wait for radar to see that there's a rotation signature, or we wait for a report from a storm spotter. This would be the kind of thing we might be able to actually provide information that an hour or two from now, it's very likely that this storm that is just beginning or hasn't even begun yet will be producing a tornado in an area. Don't really need to show you essentially what we do is you run a model of several kinds of models. You add observations. That information comes back in and changes. You rerun the model again. You get more observations, and you eventually are able to produce this probabilistic forecast system. This is what's actually done for putting forecasts out, say, for next week in the current system is attempting to provide lots of information. And in fact, at the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, they actually run an ensemble that has 100 members in it. That help provide really great information on what's going on. And we're hoping to try to do that same kind of thing on the really short time scales within a decade, sort of looking at maybe an hour or so ahead. And phased array radar, when we put the phased array radar into that kind of a system, what we actually find is if we use the phased array radar as an input into it, this is the top panel here. The top two panels are the reflectivity and vertical vorticity, which is a measure of rotation associated with a tornadic thunderstorm, and you see in particular that there's lots of strong rotation, that's the red, associated with the phased array radar data. If we put in the NEXRAD data, essentially covering the same time period, there's very little hint of very strong rotation occurring in that. And so just by bringing in the data more often from the phased array radar, you're able to produce a much more realistic picture of the circulation. At the time that this is made, there's a strong tornado on the ground associated with this storm. So that's a big deal in terms of improving our ability to make the forecast. And then also one of the other things that happens is that we can also make very short-term forecasts of the conditions within the environment. This is with the CASA network, and the arrows in here are wind barbs. The brighter colors are reflectivity. This is from the 10th of May storm last year. And we get incredible detail over, this is a total of 1 hour long for this simulation. And so every time it animates is another 5 minutes, and actually the data is coming in a lot faster than that. That allows us to get really detailed information on how the winds are changing the environment and what's going on with the storm. And it should be helpful for warning purposes, but it also is helpful in a context which we've never really considered even without the storms. Things like the wind energy community are very interested in being able to predict on short time ranges the probability of major changes in their wind, and this may provide a great deal of value for them. So there are some challenges involved in it, though. We need to be able to essentially, when you start updating data every minute or every 5 minutes, you've got to be able to figure out if the data are any good right away. And unfortunately, one of the things we deal with in meteorology all the time is that bad data, or that really important extraordinary changes that occur, frequently actually look like bad data because they're not exactly what you were expecting to happen. We have to learn a lot of things about about errors in the model themselves and how sensitive they are to various kinds of errors, and then statistical issues on how we do, how we actually bring the data into the models, and then how we can actually make effective use of ensembles on things that look at thunderstorms themselves. So last week was an extraordinary event to summarize, and we actually have some changes that are ongoing over the next decade that will hopefully dramatically improve our ability to observe what's happening and then also to forecast what's happening. So that's what I have, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Harold. That was excellent. I even understood it.
Well, thank you.
I will go to our Q&A, and to submit a question or comment, you just click on Q&A on the top menu, then you type in the top half of the little panel that opens up. Then you can either hit Enter or click on Ask. There is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that. When you do click on Ask, question will go to an administrative panel. I will announce who the question is from, read it aloud, and then our guest will respond via the conference bridge. And then I will type in a short text, okay, which will release the text of the question to the Q&A panel. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. We are ready to begin now, so you may enter your question at any time. And it may take a moment or two before we get some people have their thoughts composed enough to, and you did such a great job of covering it. There may be no questions left, Daryl.
That's okay.
I warned you I was going to ask you, what is the outlook in terms of the budget and the challenges that that's going to present in implementing some of these strategies that you just described to us?
Well, we have a new lab director who just arrived on the 24th of April, so this happened right after he came in, and we just had our first meeting with him yesterday as a lab, and we recognized that the budget doesn't necessarily look very good for next year. We're trying to do that forecasting technique is something that currently we've got on the order of $1.5 million or $2 million a year into it, and it's a much bigger project than that. So that's a real danger that budget issues will make this difficult to implement. I work in the research part of NOAA. How things get implemented on the Weather Service side is also a challenge, and the Weather Service budget certainly, the Weather Service has historically paid for a lot of that research to be done, and their budget doesn't look very good for paying for that. The phased array radar work is ongoing. One of the big issues is, you know, even if you build it, is there money to implement what's going on? The polar metric upgrades to the radars got delayed because of budget issues several times And so they should have actually been out in the field 4 years ago. So it's not, you know, we continue to do the work we can. We'll have to see what happens with the budget picture that goes with it.
And I guess support from the emergency management community would not hurt.
That's right. And I think actually one of the real interesting, I didn't mention, one of the things we're also doing some work on, we're trying to, it's a lot of it's being done by graduate students, is that one of the big questions that occurs after an event like this is that, you know, as best we can tell from the Weather Service side, there wasn't a whole lot more they could do in terms of, you know, in terms of forecasting. The forecasts were accurate. The warnings were out in plenty of time, and there's still over 300 people killed. And so the question of, you know, do we need to find better ways to communicate the information, provide better ways for people to shelter, is perhaps as big of a challenge as the meteorological side. So we've started partnering as much as we can with social scientists who can hopefully address a lot of some of those behavioral questions and some of those communication questions to attempt to improve the way we can use the forecasts that are made.
Absolutely. Okay, now we have some questions coming in.
Okay.
I do have one from Ava Jean, and she asks, Ava Jean Moore, we are almost halfway through May, which is normally normally our most severe month for storms. Are there any long-range forecasts for the rest of the month to give us some idea of what may be coming? What's the outlook?
Well, unfortunately, we can't go more than a few days or a week in advance. We're dependent essentially on what is the long-range pattern look like. And in fact, it's rare when we can see the things like last week when it was a case of, boy, last week looks, you know, looks great all out from a long way out, and what we refer to as synoptically evident from just looking at it. Right now, there's nothing that looks all that big next week that there's a lot of confidence in. It's been a quiet May so far. Today, at one point, looked like this might be a bigger day than it looks like it's going to be now. And so we really can't say much beyond that. We don't really have tools that let us do seasonal forecasting like our friends in the hurricane community do. So it's and we know historically that having a busy or a slow part of the beginning of the season tells us really almost nothing about what the rest of the year is going to be like.
Gotcha.
So you're on your own.
Right. Always just stay tuned to what you're hearing from locally. Okay, we have a question from Joe Sukaska. I expect he was composing this as you were discussing, you know, the behavioral issues. But he asked, with a relatively large number of tornadoes occurring, how effective were public notification and warning systems? Did public awareness get saturated by the probably large number of warnings?
Well, this is, I think, one of the really, really interesting questions. It covers in the background, there's a question that I really wish I knew the answer to, and that is, I don't know what the public actually understands by the word warning. I know that the National Weather Service has a very technical meaning for the word warning, and it's very precise, and I don't know if there's any human being in the country that actually uses the word in the same way as the Weather Service does. And that's one of the big things is that people – If you look on average, and last week was obviously an extraordinary week, but if you look on average, the highest place in the country that historically has gotten the most tornado warnings is Harris County, Texas, which is Houston. And they're under tornado warnings on average 6 hours a year. So the question of saturation is really hard for me because I know that by the formal meaning, if 6 hours is a lot, and where I live in central Oklahoma, we average 1 hour of warning a year. If that saturates, that's a huge problem. But I suspect that a lot of people sort of have some kind of a spatial scale, and they think that, you know, if for here we get the little map on our television screens if there's severe weather occurring in the area, and I wonder if people think that if the map shows up, I've been warned. And on the other side of that same question is that we almost after every event you'll hear people say, "I didn't, you know, I we didn't get a warning." You know, it hit without warning. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that people don't use what we use as a technical phrase. They use it in a very different way. But if we want people to actually respond, they need to be, you know, we need to find out what they understand. Last week there were some issues there with some power outages that occurred in the morning. The systems had not gotten back up by the afternoon. And there is, while I don't think this was a very big problem, there is at least one couple that in some of the stories in the newspapers said that they were, that family members said that they were unaware of the warning because the power had been out and they weren't getting any information in at all. And we know that wasn't incredibly common because there are a lot of other stories where people were clearly aware of what was going on and attempted to take shelter, or in one case, young man decided that he would rather take a nap than go with his girlfriend to the shelter, to the storm shelter. And so he slept his way through the tornado and was killed.
I have a question from Ed McDonough, and he's referring to the new technology you were showing us. He says, how valuable will these tools be in areas where the topography affects tornado activity, such as the Mid-Atlantic area, where the rolling topography often leads to shorter duration tornadoes that come and go very quickly?
Well, there are some advantages to some of the new radar technologies that we can essentially see lower. Right now, even if you're in flat terrain, the lowest radar elevation tilts up above the ground. We can actually, with the new technologies, turn them to a lower angle, but also the gap filling radars may be really valuable in that case. If you've got a particular area of concern, you could presumably put one or two of those low powered radars in that area. And as far as you're only looking 20 to 30 miles distant at the most, and those radars would be able to see those kinds of things and wouldn't be as affected by the terrain. So that's a real promising area that can be used in, I think.
Yeah. I have a question from James A. Everwine, and it overlapped again with one of your responses. But he says, with a tremendous advance in technology, with advanced warning time and rapid news updates from the cable industry, why do you think so many people died? You answered part of my question, but were these communities hardest hit there in 1974?
I think the big question is, why were there so many fatalities? And there are a couple of things. One was these were violent tornadoes, you know, as strong as tornadoes get, moving through populated areas, and that's just at the beginning. That's not necessarily a good combination. There are a large fraction of the deaths that occurred in mobile homes. What I've been working on the last 2 weeks, it seems like all the time, and again today, is trying to figure out where people were when they were killed. We right now have gotten about 40% of the locations figured out, and it's two-thirds of the ones that were in homes were in mobile homes at this point. And some of the other ones that there was one person I was reading about that the home, from looking at the property records, the home was built in 1920, was described as being in poor condition, and had a metal corrugated roof. So my image of that is that probably wasn't a very sturdy structure either. One of the problems we've got in the southeastern United States is the high mobile home fraction, whereas overall in the nation, it's about 7% of housing units are mobile homes. In the southeast U.S., it's over 15%. In parts of the southeast, South Carolina, for instance, over 20% of the housing units in the country, in the state, are mobile homes. And even not very strong tornadoes in mobile homes are bad. And if you put a very strong tornado in there, it's really a big problem.
Right. Question from Isabel McCurdy, and she's referring to the various maps and so radar images that you showed. She said, Howard, these images look pretty to me. Do folks who live in tornado region get trained to understand what these images mean?
I think so. We actually have a PhD student here at the University of Oklahoma who's One of the things she's going to be looking at is essentially people's understanding of those kinds of images. I hang around with a perhaps a skewed distribution of people, but everybody around here that I talk to knows what a hook echo is, and you get a pretty good sense of what that means. And even on our local television stations, they show velocity images where people actually get. I think we're developing a pretty good feeling for that. I'm not sure how widespread that view is, especially as you go further away, and especially in some cases. I mean, last week was radar 101. They were signatures that you get taught if you take a radar meteorology class. That they aren't always that clean and easy to see. I think that comes back to this. One of our big questions that just has not been enough attention has been given to it is what the public understanding of things like that is. Is it the kind of thing that perhaps we should be showing that all the time? People, let them see that raw radar image, and they'll know that this is really bad. Or perhaps, a large number of people, that just looks like a red blob, and they don't understand the fact that actually it's the southwest corner of the blob that's actually important to them, to where it may be confusing them. There may be people who think they're in much more danger than they are, and other people who think, well, it doesn't look like it's raining very hard where I am on the radar. I must be okay, when in fact they're in the worst possible spot to be.
Right. And I will chime in on that. When I was working in emergency management locally, I mean, our local weather forecast office really did work closely, at least with emergency management community, in explaining those signatures and so forth.
Yeah. The National Weather Service, each forecast office, and there's about 120 offices around the country, there is a person that's their job, is to help public understanding. And so I think emergency managers get a lot of training in that. There's probably another set of people that ought to get more training. That if you were the manager of a large hospital or something, where you've had a lot of vulnerable people in your care, those kinds of people also would probably be useful. If you have to move everybody out of some part of the hospital, and that's going to take you a long time, you may need to be more aware of what the weather is doing than the average citizen does.
And plus, you may need to gear up for injuries and fatalities.
That's right. Yeah, that was on the May 3rd, 1999 tornado. I had a lot of discussions with our public health people after it in Oklahoma City, and they had a really good plan for how to deal with mass casualties. And in fact, that's what they had implemented in the Murrah bombing in 1995. When the tornadoes occurred, one of the things they hadn't really thought about was, well, the main part of the tornado, the tornado's a mile wide in places, and you basically can't cross the path that night. And so the tornado is off-center of the metropolitan area, and there's only one major hospital to the south of it. So half of the victims ended up going to that hospital because they couldn't go across the damage path.
Right.
And so even everybody was supposed to get 50 patients, well, the one hospital gets a few hundred.
Harold, let me wrap up on one last issue. We do have a link to your YouTube interview, and I'll refer folks to that for a little bit more. But could you just mention, the long-term historical trends associated with La Nina, what you think about global warming and so forth?
Sure. There's some evidence that La Nina has an impact on tornado occurrence. The really big thing is that El Nino is unfavorable for tornadoes in most of the central United States. But it's not completely, eliminating them. But La Nina appears to be the kind of thing that maybe, gives you a few extra percent. Maybe it's like you're flipping a coin with 55% instead of 50% on the coin. And it, although we have seen some of our biggest outbreaks have been in La Nina years. So that's still a big area for research. As far as climate change is concerned, we've got a couple of problems in doing some identification. The reporting database has changed over the years to where you really can't look historically without doing a lot of adjustments to the record, and at that point it's hard to pick out signals. Our expectations as the planet's warmed over the last 40 to 50 years, it'll continue to warm over the next century. And what will happen, we expect, is that one of the ingredients that's important for significant tornadoes and for significant severe thunderstorms, one of those ingredients is going to become more favorable, the other primary ingredients become less favorable. And so the balance between those two is very hard to pick out. We really can't see anything in the historical record that says that much has happened, if any. So that's a really unknown question. And in fact, doing some real simple simulations of data, you can show that even if there's a fairly large effect, say a 5 to 10% change, which is a big number physically over the next century, that the fact that some years are big and some years are small anyway, it'll probably take 50 to 60 years of data collection done consistently to actually see any changes. And since we aren't going to keep the system consistent, probably it'll be a very long time before we can tell if global warming has any impact on tornadoes.
And with that, we'll wrap it up. Thank you so much, Harold.
You're welcome.
Wonderful presentation. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us again, and we do appreciate what you and all your colleagues do.
Well, thank you. We appreciate what the emergency management community does.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll put Harold's contact information if we had a question we didn't have time to get to today. Before you run off, we do ask you to complete this little rating form, which is the rating is based on relevance, and please feel free to share your comments. Do need to make a couple of announcements. As I mentioned last time, emforum.org now has a page on Facebook, so please do stop by when you have a chance. And then our next program will take place Wednesday, May 25th, and our topic will be the U.S. Geological Survey's efforts to support emergency management with its natural hazards mission area. And this will be an opportunity to provide feedback as they develop a strategy for the future. Please do make plans to join us at that time. Again, thanks for everyone for participating today. Thanks for the excellent questions. Please join us again. Have a great afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.